Morning, everyone. I'm looking for the date. Today is April 12th, 2014. Welcome to the morning session of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. Happy to see so many people in the audience here. We've got quite a few people who've signed up to provide public testimony, and that's the first item on the agenda, so we'll jump into that. The commission provides citizens with 3 minutes to present your viewpoints and comments. When you hear the beeping noise, that means that your 3 minutes has lapsed, and we'd like you to conclude your remarks. Please come forward to the front table. Sit in front of a microphone. You don't have to be real close to the mic. They're pretty sensitive, so sit back a little bit and provide us with your comments. I'll call you up two at a time. Joe Verdos, you're first, and Ron Garner.
Morning, Commissioner and Madam Chairman. Got to listen to NPR coming down today, so it's a good ride that way. 2.5 hours NPR is not bad. I learned also that April is math month, so in celebration of that, I'm going to give you some math facts. So this will be a slightly different testimony than I've given in the past. So I'm represent Puget Sound Prawn Association or Shrimp Association, and I'm going to give you some numbers on what I do on a trip. One trip costs me 35 gallons of diesel, and on that trip I catch 600 pounds of prawns, which actually I do in one trip generally. I have enough capacity, so one day a week I go and I get 600 pounds of prawns. The average in a pound of prawns is about 14.5 prawns per pound, so that means I'm coming home with 8,700 prawns, which might seem like a heck of a lot of prawns. To some degree it is, but I represent a lot of consumers, not just myself. So I'm figuring 6 prawns per dinner. That means I'm coming home with 1,450 consumer meals on that day. So if you take that 8,700 pounds prawns and you divide it that by 80 prawns, that's a consumer limit, that's a recreational limit, that's 108.75 consumer recreational limits. And you divide that by 1.5, that equals about 72.5 recreational trips. And I figure this is where my assumptions are maybe a little weird or not accurate, because I just did the best I could. I'm figuring 10 gallons of fuel per sports trip, so that's, you know, I figure 305 horsepower. That's 750 gallons of fuel used to catch the same prawns that I caught. And that's 540 gallons of fuel per week used by recreational fishermen to catch the same prawns I caught with 35 gallons. So if you figure in 1 week, there's 18 of us doing that, and you multiply that times 750 gallons, that's 13,500 gallons of fuel used to catch what we catch with 540 gallons. I think from going from a 60-40 split to a 70-30 split is kind of not environmentally very secure thing to do. I think it's an overreach. You'll get to be able to look some of the effects later in the day when Rich fills you in the briefing of last year. But I still think when the legislature created us in 2001 and set a 60-40 split and created the economics for our situation then, you've done us a disservice. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you. David Jennings, please come forward. Okay, Mr. Garner.
Morning, everybody. And first, I'd like to say thanks to the commission and Phil and everything. I know the Pacific Fisheries Management Council north of Falcon was pretty grueling. I can't imagine how drained you are, because I was on and off the phone the whole time with my buddies that were in there, and I got to say, it drained me, too. And I just appreciate how much effort it took to pull this off. I know that all of us were really looking hard on which option to go and do we go into uncharted territory, and I think that was a pretty dangerous move to probably do that. But anyway, thanks for all your hard work and still coming up with a season to fish. What I would like to talk about is the 900,000 steelhead smolts. I know that the Wild Fish Conservancy does not want to see those fish released into the river system, but we absolutely want to see them released into the river system. We want to see no deals cut whatsoever, no hatcheries closed, and those hatchery fish will take a hit for the wild fish that are in the river by cormorants and everything else. But we can't allow lawsuits to start determining how our fisheries are run. I've had the tribes calling me. I've had about everybody calling me you could think of. And we don't want this to set precedence that hatchery fish are no good and that we need to take them out, because that is kind of making that statement in not so many words. So I want to just let you know that we're working on it from our end, too, but we're not trying to leave you guys out there hanging. We're going to do everything we can to make this thing happen with no deal with Wild Fish Conservancy. You know, I understand their point. They have their points, too, and I'm not trying to drag them through the mud on it, but we just want to say that we want a line drawn in the sand and no deal. And on the crab and shrimp, I'd like to say I think Rich Childers and Mark O'Toole have done an excellent job of managing it. We have a lot of happy customers. I'm still amazed at how many people had never shrimped before that have. That to me, I thought were longtime shrimpers, guys that were up in their 60s and never done it before, and they've had just a fantastic time. You've made a lot of people happy with both policies. So I just wanted to say thank you on our behalf. The smelt, I'll talk about later, but I just wanted to say I know how much work it is that all you do, and we really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Gordon, Rue, Mr. Jennings, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director Anderson, Deputy Director Storr. We're here to talk about lingcod and cabazon. Lingcod is a very popular fishery. Back in the early 90s, we had very liberal seasons, and very few lingcod were being caught. And so the department courageously closed the seasons for a couple of years and really built the stocks back up. When the fishery was reopened, you also put into place a more restrictive fishing regulations, a one per person and a much shorter season. Cabazon hasn't been treated that way, but last year at the March commission meeting, you did adopt changes to the cabazon rule. You took it from two fish per person per day down to one, and you put in a minimum length regulation of, I think, 18 inches. I still have concerns that isn't sufficient to actually help us rebuild the cabazon population. Cabazon back in the 70s were reported as both abundant and ubiquitous, all over the place in a lot of them. Now that's not what we're seeing in our fishing creel reports. At the Fish Committee last year, and also at the open commission discussion on the fishing and sports fishing regulations, the discussion was that based on what happened this past season, the department and the commission was going to look at the number of cabazon caught, and if that number was really low, was going to come back and say, do we really need to close the season or at least reduce it to be the same length of time as the lingcod? I haven't seen the numbers coming out from this year, but I would like to say I am looking forward to seeing the numbers, and I'm hoping that if they I don't want them to be bad, but I have very concerns. I have concerns that we're going to see very low numbers being reported that were of the legal length and total numbers landed. And if that's the case, please go back and look at whether or not we need to restrict further the regulate fishing management on cabazon so we can rebuild the population. I want a healthy, robust fishery in cabazon. I'm not trying to close it over permanently. I'm trying to build it back up so we can have it, cabazon, functionally present in Puget Sound. Right now, they're so rare that they're incidental as opposed to ubiquitous and abundant, and that's what I wanted to get back to. Thank you.
Thank you. Wayne Klein. Mr.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, my name is Gordon Rue. I'm a member of Snow King Puget Sound Anglers and also a member of the both the Crab and the Shrimp Recreational Fishing Advisory Group. I'd like to comment on both the crab and the shrimp season for this past year. First, in terms of shrimp, first year of the new policy, very successful. We saw a 33% increase in angler effort this year. In particular, we saw increased opportunity near the major metropolitan areas. That's always appreciated. People don't have to travel far to take advantage of this. And the department also was willing to work with the recreational group and develop new strategies so that in other areas, we tried new techniques. We fished half days rather than full days to fully take advantage of the new opportunity that was there. So, again, Ron already touched on it, but we'd like to thank Rich and Mark O'Toole for working with us on the shrimp. Marine Area 7 West is an area that has come up from discussion quite a bit. That was an area where when our group, working with staff, put together the season for 2013, we were overly conservative. We set the season at 3 days a week. There was new opportunity under that policy, and we were too strict in the number of days we allocated for fishing. Consequently, as we the season moved on, it became apparent that there was going to be quota that our side could not take. That was approximately $170,000 worth of shrimp that was transferred from our side to the commercial fishers. They took advantage of that. It works out to about $9,500 a commercial license. Before the recreational season even ended last year, we were already working with staff to develop kind of a new format for this year. That'll be rolled out by Rich later on today. But I think we'll see greater success. We know from past history we'll see more participation in the Western San Juans. We look forward to that. Jumping to crab quickly, again, for the most part, successful season, with the exception of maybe South Sound. South Sound's proving to be a challenge with the tribes and their new fishing patterns. We're having to adopt a look at new seasons, maybe earlier openers in the past. Rich is going to speak to that. And we encourage the department to give the recreational fishers in those areas opportunity by starting the season a little bit earlier. It sounds like we're finally going to move forward on the purchase of this research boat, money coming out of the Crab Endorsement Fund. We're behind that 100%. There's a lot of work to be done. We want to see expanded research on Tanner crab. We want to see more derelict gear removed. They need that boat, and we're pleased that it's going to be put into service. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Franson. Mr. Klein, you can go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Good to see you guys again. I'm not here about shrimp or crab. I'm here about the Skagit River. It's been nearly 7 years since the decision to list them as threatened, and there's still no provision to allow for individual basin performance to determine any kind of fishery. A fishery needs two main ingredients, fish and anglers. Neither are in short supply on the Skagit. Our returns last year were nearly 8,800 fish, one of the most robust. It is the most robust run in Puget Sound. So the hard part's done. The fish are back. The fish are there. The only remaining obstacles are regulatory in nature, mostly due to poor planning at the federal level by overlooking that many, if not all, streams might recover at different rates instead of all at the same time. So to the layman, we don't understand why not fishing the Skagit is going to help the Nooksack. We don't understand why not fishing the Skagit is going to help the Puyallup. We don't understand why not fishing the Skagit is going to help the Stillaguamish. We're just laymen. We don't understand how any of this can work, but apparently that's the way it's set up. We need to do something, and I think it needs to start with WDFW. And in my business experience, I have always found that if the task is not scheduled and assigned to somebody, it never gets done. So one of the things that several things we'd like to find out is if it's been assigned to someone, who that person might be, and if there's anything at all that we can do to help move this along. And in closing, I would like to briefly mention that in the last year. Everyone I've talked to at WDFW about this likes to mention monitoring of any proposed fishery. And I'm sure I'm not the only one to think of this, but I'll mention it just to get it on the record, that a possible solution would be catch record cards for wild steelhead encounters with a mandatory return and or angler-submitted end-of-season surveys by mail or online. And we should probably hammer people hard about returning these things. In other words, make it part of your eligibility to fish for the next season. And that's all I have today. Thank you.
Thank you. Kurt Kramer? Okay, Mr. Franson.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director, Deputy. I'm Steve Franson from Olympia, and I was here last year giving much the same testimony. I'm going to reiterate some of what I said last year and ask what progress is being made. You've already heard and hopefully know well and good, the Skagit is the most conservatively managed steelhead population in the state, if not on the entire West Coast. The MSY escapement goal, which we do not recommend, is less than 4,000 fish, but the operative escapement guideline since 1991 of 6,000 fish is 150% of the MSY value, which buffers errors in run forecasting. I said before, the way you recover a depressed anadromous fish run is to reduce or eliminate the limiting factor. But the data say that harvest, direct, indirect, and incidental catch and release mortality have not been a factor affecting wild Skagit steelhead abundance since 1976. Therefore, the Skagit wild steelhead population varies around its contemporary natural carrying capacity. The proximate cause limiting adult steelhead stock abundance is marine survival. This is supported by the Pacific Ocean Salmon Tracking Project results. It's clear to say any objective examiner that the catch and release season is not inconsistent with steelhead survival and recovery, assuming Skagit steelhead are in need of recovering. NIMS 2007 steelhead status review observed that the elimination of direct harvest of wild steelhead in the mid-1990s has largely addressed any problem of fishing mortality. In its ESA listing, NIMS also said, "We will work with all stakeholders to help ensure that recovery planning proceeds apace so that Puget Sound steelhead continue to provide the spectrum of ecological, cultural, and economic benefits that underscore their status as the state fish of Washington." That was 2007, and NIMS only recently began working on the Puget Sound steelhead recovery plan and beginning to understand what apace means. I was asked at the Occupy Skagit fish-in 2 weeks ago, what visible indication is there that anything has changed? So I would like to hear directly what WDFW has done in the last year to move the Skagit steelhead management plan forward. Lack of a Skagit Basin-specific steelhead management plan approved by NIMS is the primary obstacle to restoring the Skagit steelhead fishing seasons. We understand from the Skagit Basin Treaty Tribes, Upper Skagit, Swinomish, and Sauk, Suattle, that the present Puget Sound arbitrary aggregate one-size-fits-all incidental take limit of 4.2% constrains their salmon fishing seasons. The elements of a viable Skagit plan exist already in the 2010 draft Puget Sound plan. Appendix C of that plan, written by the late and well-respected biologist Bob Heyman, extensively analyzes recovery exploitation rates. The short story is that Skagit steelhead will not go extinct under any contemplated treaty and non-treaty fishing in the next 100 years. An approved Skagit Basin plan could permit catch-and-release steelhead seasons to be implemented with no measurable risk to future population abundance. Anglers in the community could enjoy the social and economic benefits associated with the fishery. These benefits could be enjoyed while simultaneously conserving wild Skagit steelhead. And it's just about that simple. Meanwhile, I convert my dollars to loonies and fished more days for steelhead in British Columbia this past year than in my home state. We still need your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Zickowitz. Okay, Mr. Kramer.
Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director Anderson, Deputy Director Storer. Thank you for your time. I'm here again to talk about Occupy Skagit and the Skagit steelhead situation, and I'll talk a little more about some of the fish management and what's going on in the basin. As Steve said, the Skagit steelhead are one of the most conservatively managed populations on the West Coast. With the escapement goal, in addition, there's been an effective 16% cap on exploitation rates that runs above 6,000 on the Skagit since 1991. Or 94, I guess it was. This assures that the average escapements will be well above MSY levels, and also assures that on large runs, the exploitation rates are capped. So you'll see larger runs. If the run's 10,000 fish, you'll see an escapement of 8,400 steelhead, which continually challenges the amount of habitat the Skagit Basin currently has, as well as whatever habitat might be restored. And there'd be enough steelhead to challenge whatever we have there to produce there. There's a way the current estimate of carrying capacity in the Skagit River is around 9,000 fish. As Steve said, last year the escapement was about 8,700, challenging the carrying capacity of the basin. More importantly, as you might recall from last year when we talked about probably not looking at official numbers of fish in the Skagit until maybe 2015 or 2016, and that was because in 2009 we saw the lowest escapement of Skagit wild steelhead it's in the 35-year history of the data that we have there. There was 2,500 fish spawn. 4 years later, we saw a run size of almost 9,000 fish, 8,900 and some fish, of which a couple hundred died in hooking mortality. This is a spectacular increase. In fact, it's if you look at the two brood years that contributed, you're looking at approximately two fish for every spawner returning, which is, when you look at a depressed or low population, this is a very robust spawning and speaks much about the health of the Skagit wild steelhead. In fact, I would go so far as to say in ESA stocks, that kind of response is very atypical and unheard of in Puget Sound. In my perusing the issue, I found a 2008 Department of Fish and Wildlife report about Omicus and assessments of populations and programs of steelhead in the state. And in looking at the Skagit population, they assessed extinction risk, and their assessment was that the risk of extinction with Skagit steelhead in 2008 was zero, 100 years from now. And I remind the commission that in 2008, there were still directed fisheries on wild steelhead in the Skagit Basin, and there had been over 25 years of catch-and-release fishing during the spring of the year. And it's clear that what's been going on in the Skagit the last two decades and what we hope to see to continue to go on is not a risk to the steelhead. Virtually everyone that's evaluated that has found that. I'd like to talk a little bit about the spawning in the Skagit Basin. There's roughly 290 miles of steelhead spawning habitat, of which 170 miles of that today is set aside as a de facto wild steelhead management or wild salmon management zone or gene bank. Those areas are either closed to all fishing, catch and release with selective gear, non-retention of everything but hatchery steelhead. And this is dramatic. I doubt there's any other basin in the state of Washington that has that much habitat set aside in for a gene bank, if you will. Thank you.
Thank you. Leland Miyawaki? Okay, Mr. Zakowski.
Hi, my name is Bill Zitkowitz. My first time at a meeting here. I look forward to meeting you guys. I've never done this. I'm a passionate steelheader. I won't talk on the numbers like Steve and Kurt can. I will say that my money for steelheading, I've been steelheading for about 12 years. I'm willing to spend my money in this state, but I don't like how crowded certain places have become, like the Olympic Peninsula, the Klickitat, stuff like that. So the rivers I've grown up fishing are the Snoqualmie and the Skykomish. I've spent a lot of time up on the Skagit and the Sauk. I did get a couple seasons in on the catch-and-release season for the Skagit. And for the reasons that most of these guys have talked about, I support that, and that's why I'm here today. I think we as anglers bring a ton of money into the local economy for concrete, for cedar woolly, for all the little towns up there, the restaurants. I know a lot of businesses are struggling up there, and I'm willing to spend my money up there. I'm willing to go to BC or the Clearwater or Oregon, but I'd like to keep my money in the state and be able to fish. I had a few years where I fished over 150 days a year, so I'm willing to put in a lot of time doing it. I have worked a little bit in the industry. I recently worked at Orvis, and I teach casting and just am passionate for the steelhead. The only questions I would raise, and it's follow-up to what the Steve and Kurt have talked about, is monitoring. What's the cost of monitoring, and also what has been done in the last year? I'll follow up with what Steve said. So if you guys can address that at some time, that would be great. I thank you for your time. Pleasure meeting you guys.
Thank you. Daryl Thompson, Mr. Miyawaki.
Hi. I'm Leland Miyawaki, and, you know, a couple of years ago, I was invited by Chris DeLeon to meet with a bunch of guys at Bob's Burgers in Marysville, and it was kind of the beginnings of Occupy Skagit. Now, I'm no biologist, and I'm certainly not as smart as Kurt and Wayne and Steve and the guys, so I suspect it was because I lived through the 60s, and I knew a little bit about protests, civil disobedience, and how to make signs. So there it is. There's a bunch of other guys that are here from Occupy Skagit. So it was a wait-in, and that to me was actually kind of fun. Now, I think a lot of has been said about numbers and escapement and habitat and stuff, but, you know, what I want to talk about is, today is April 12, and it's forecast to be about 60 to 70 degrees outside. I could be stepping into the Skagit River now and not having to wear everything I own. Taking that heavy sink tip off the fly line, taking that 2-3 inch big heavy weighted intruder fly off, get the two-handed rod out and fling it out there with a floating line. Hopefully the water's getting close to 50 degrees. Maybe in the hopes of catching a big bright wild buck coming up to a surface fly, skated across the water. You know, I'm like going to be 71 years old sometime this year, and damn, I'd love to be doing this next year instead of being here at a meeting like this. Thank you.
That was really terrific testimony, I got to tell you. Thank you so much. Andrew Lawrence? Okay, Mr. Thompson, try to top that.
So my name is Daryl Thompson, and I live in Marysville, Washington, and I'd like to say thanks for the opportunity to come here and talk to you about this. I'm representing the Skagit River catch and release season to try to get it open. I spend at least 2 weeks a year going up to Canada steelhead fishing. It cost me between $1,500 and $2,000 to do it, and I'm conserving every cost I can to keep it at that number. So many people that I've met up there have traveled from different countries to enjoy the steelhead fishing opportunity, and I'm sure they've spent a lot more money than I have to do it. I've enjoyed my trips, however, I would rather spend my time and money here fishing on the Skagit and Sauk Rivers. Before the system closed to catch and release, I remember meeting people, they were local people, and from many other states within our country, and other countries as well, and some of them were even Canadians, and they don't come down here to fish. So their trips were a week or more, and they spent money locally to enjoy it in towns like Concrete, Cedar, Woolley. So I've been fortunate enough to enjoy some very good years fishing these rivers, and I miss spending February through April exploring the river and listening to the birds and watching winter turn into spring. It's a much more enjoyable experience than spending time indoors. It is a special place, and the steelhead fishing is among the best in the world, and if you've ever experienced it, you would agree. So two different very successful fly line companies, Rio and Airflow, have named more than one series of fly line after the Skagit. They're sold around the world, and I don't know what their sales are, but I can guarantee they've made a lot of money doing it. So a regular fisherman on the Skagit before the catch and release closure, who many people know, came up with a fly pattern called the Intruder. In the last 10 years, it's probably one of the most advertised steelhead patterns there is, and everyone associates it with the Skagit River. The Skagit River is a treasure in the state of Washington that should be available for public and especially those who haven't had the chance to experience it its wonderful steelhead fishing opportunities. So please help us open this river back up. It's a great gem, and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Lawrence?
This is my first time doing this, so I don't know if I can really add much to what the other gentlemen here have said about Occupy Skagit. Other than that, I support what they're about, and as an angler, I'm willing to pay whatever sort of endorsement needs in order to monitor the fishery. I catch and release season is underway. So, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Really excellent set of testimony this morning. Very informative, and I remember the discussion that we had last year about this time with the Occupy Skagit contingent came down. But I wondered if I could offer the director an opportunity to respond to some of the comments.
Chair, thanks, Madam Chair. Morning, everybody. Well, I think everybody's aware of the challenges associated with modifying the decision by National Marine Fisheries Service to list steelhead under the Endangered Species Act and look at change that dynamic such that we can look at individual systems within the evolutionary significant unit. You know, I'm well aware of and I saw it in the testimony, the passion around this issue and the fact that we have, with all the bad news we have relative to Puget Sound steelhead, we have one system, the Skagit system, which is shown a remarkable deviation from the pattern we have everywhere else. Looking at this system and trying to look for ways to manage this system separately and distinctly from the other systems, which have very, very significant issues associated with wild fish survival and productivity, is one that we indicated support of, and we're working through this process and I'm not trying to offer, well, maybe you think I'm trying to offer excuses, but working through this process and to get us to a point that where we can manage this system independently involves working with our tribal co-managers, which we have taken steps to do. We have consensus, we have agreement with the tribes on pursuing this avenue of making changes such that we can manage this system independently of the rest of the systems within the ESU. We have, following getting to that point, we've reached out to NOAA and talked with them to see if they would be receptive to us bringing forward a proposal that would have us manage this system independently, and they were. It's the next step of how we go about initiating a bureaucratic term of scoping with the tribes to try to get this issue in front of NOAA in a way that would allow us to get a permit for the fishery to take place and have us manage this system independent of the balance of the ESU that we're working on. I would invite if Jim Scott, our assistant director of the fish program, may have a couple of additional details that he might want to provide. I don't know if he does in addition to what I've said. But we have been working on this issue. It's not easy. That's not an excuse. It's not easy. But we support trying to manage this system independently and separately and distinctively from the balance of the systems within Puget Sound. And we've made some progress. We're not moving as fast as we all hope, particularly you. But we have the same goal.
Commissioners, would you like to hear? Jim, why don't you come up and we'll have a little conversation about this. I'm not on the Fish Committee, and I haven't been briefed in detail about the kinds of steps in the process and the considerations that NOAA would apply in reviewing this proposal. But what does it mean that they are receptive, and what do you see as the hurdles that we would, and the timeline?
So I'm Jim Scott, Assistant Director for the Fish Program. Appreciate the opportunity to speak to this. And I thought between the public comment and Director Anderson's observations gave a pretty good picture of the situation on the Skagit. It's very encouraging that we've seen the increase in escapements that we've seen the last 3 years now, I think, and remain hopeful that that trend will continue here in the future. Because throughout the rest of Puget Sound, the steelhead situation over the last 5 years has been very, very difficult. So on the Skagit itself, one of the public commenters, it might have been Steve Franson, mentioned that we have previously invested quite a bit of work in developing a Skagit-specific analysis for wild steelhead. NOAA, when we tried to go down that route previously, NOAA had some concerns about it. And so I think the challenge will be to have a strong enough technical analysis that clearly illustrates what level of mortality would be consistent with survival and recovery of steelhead in the Skagit River. And in the letter back to us from NOAA, they laid out what they would be wanting to see. It's not surprisingly, it's consistent with their 40 rule limit requirements. Nothing surprising there. But they, given the status of Puget Sound steelhead as a whole, they want to be very comfortable with whatever change would be proposed for the Skagit River. So we I believe in November that we received the letter back from NOAA indicating that they would be willing to gauge in a discussion about the Skagit-specific plan. And since that time, I've had two conversations with policy leads for the Skagit River tribes, kind of scoping out what it would potentially look like. I think there's kind of broad agreement about how to move down that path, and our technical staff have been directed to begin that process. So it's a good step forward, and boy, it's nice to see some steelhead returns to the Skagit.
Let me just ask you follow up. The monitoring or the research that would be needed to provide them with a good basis of information, how long would that take, do you think?
I think there's two parts to the, there's many parts to what they'll be looking for, but one is what's the allowable impact rate that's consistent with survival and recovery? And then second, if we have a fishery, and let's say on the recreational side, it's a catch and release fishery at perhaps low, at relatively low abundance levels for the steelhead. If it's a catch and release fishery, currently we don't have a monitoring program in place in any of our Western Washington or Puget Sound rivers where we try and estimate how many wild steelhead were encountered and released. And so on a big system like the Skagit, that could be quite expensive. We've got one going on the Quilly River this year, and it's roughly $150,000 or so to put it in place. Another big river system. So we're going to need to look at what alternatives we have available, maybe a combination of the on-the-water creel survey approach, which is expensive but gives us good information, maybe pairing that up with a long-term with a catch record card approach that one of the public commenters suggested, or maybe there's some special permitting licensing possibilities that we could put in place on the Skagit that would require you to specifically report your encounters if you are allowed to fish on the Skagit River itself. So those are the types of options that we're exploring.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Carpenter?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pretty familiar with this, and I think it's safe to say that the majority of the people that are interested in a catch-and-release Skagit steelhead fishery would take the position of being very much self-policing. I mean, they will do whatever it takes to enable this fishery to take place, and any people that are on the river that aren't playing by the rules won't be on the river, playing by any rules. When you're talking to people that are purists, that are primarily fly fishing, they're very respectful of the resource, and I think, again, they'd be thankful for the opportunity. The average stakeholder, constituent, or whatever we choose to call these folks, in all fairness, they have to come to us because they have no access to NOAA. I mean, they can write letters, and they may or may not ever get a response. And so the only place they can come to address their concerns are with us. And they've done it now for a couple of years. And I just want to say this. On behalf of people making public comment about a question or a need or a desire, the professionalism of these folks is the way things should be done, and I'm very appreciative of it.
Commissioner Smith.
I would be greatly remiss if I didn't support my colleague, Commissioner Carpenter, in this. Oftentimes, when we do have testimony, it can lead to a lot of anger and frustration, and what was presented today was outstanding, and I compliment all of you that did that. The blend of fact, passion, and humor can go a long ways in making a point, and your point was well made, so you have my support.
Right. Okay. Well, Fish Committee, it's on your agenda. This is going to take some follow-up, obviously. You're not going to go away with the perfect solution today, but we'll accept a commitment that we'll be working on it. Okay. That concludes.